Anjan, how's everything going, man?
Nice to meet you, Jimmy, again.
It's going well. So you're not the typical person that I would have. Actually, maybe you are, because you're like a startup founder and all that stuff. But the topic that we're going to talk about is not something that I think most people really have put too much thought into, and that's our relationship to our devices. And I brought you on because I think you're actually doing something about it. But before we get to that, can you tell us a little, tell my audience a little bit about your background and, obviously the company you're building and the devices that you're creating and so on?
Yeah, I think one good way to describe me is it's incredibly dangerous to be super ADHD and have a super tiger mom, because you don't realize you're super ADHD. I was like really good at school. I did well. I did all these extracurriculars. I was just super organized, like overscheduled. And I just was like, oh, I'm just good at stuff. And then I went to college. And thankfully, I was able to have my super tiger mom not follow me. And I just crashed and burned. Because all these things I thought were part of me were actually provided by this exoskeleton of a crazy Indian woman. And so I think that's a good way to describe me, is I have... I have this streak of being just incredibly ADHD, and I feel like a computer is not built for a brain like mine. You know, there's this theory of hunters and gatherers, and ADHD people were particularly great hunters because they're always, you know, picking things to be salient in their environment. And so in my context, what that just meant is I had 500 tabs. And I go sit down to write an essay in college. And the next thing you know, I have 800 tabs. And I 3 hours trying to close yesterday's tab and just created more. And you just feel incompetent that you can't get things done. Because every single time you're on your computer, you're always fighting yourself. You're fighting your computer. So I think my story is one of feeling like I need to blame myself, because I think I'm smart. I think I'm hardworking. I think I got potential. But so often, all I would do is waste time on a computer all the time. And it led me to like discover stuff like Bitcoin early. I mean, it led me to like interesting rabbit holes. But a lot of time, it just led me to feel like I'm not going to be successful. And so in many ways, whether it be like, you know, starting up Daylight or my journey along the way, it was almost like reclaiming my sovereignty, my agency, my sense of like self-trust in regards to computers, because in many ways, it's our most important non-human relationship. It's our intermediary to the rest of the world, to the rest of knowledge. And that is both terrifying and absolutely magical if we can get working right.
Yeah, your story, I think, is very similar to a lot of people in the sense that we're supposed to have these things that are supposed to be giant productivity multipliers, but they actually end up being distractions, right? Like they almost take over your mind and your actions in many ways. How many people like end up doom scrolling for hours and hours, after being like, oh, I'll just go check email. No, you're not. You're going to go look at YouTube shorts or something like that for the next 4 hours and like feel terrible about yourself afterwards. It's an addiction. And a lot of people really have like a deeply dysfunctional relationship with their devices. And I think that's what you've described. So, tell me more about, that relationship and what your insight has been and what led you to, start the company that you have and so on.
Yeah, I think I want to give like three frames. One is this concept of evolutionary mismatch. Second is kind of the homogenization of our schooling system that then leads to homogenization of the people who build, which leads to homogenization of these interfaces or computers. And then the third is just what psychology calls like fundamental attribution error, which the flip side of that is environmental design. So yeah, let's see if I remember the three points that are coming up for me. So I think when it comes to our relationship with technology, the grand frame that has been very helpful for me, and I'm curious how it lands for you, is this evolutionary mismatch. So I was like a judgmental person. I'd look at people eating like Krispy Kremes and I'd just be like, oh, you gross, fucking sick person. Like, what are you doing poisoning yourselves? I see people like just eating like triple deep fried stuff, or, you know, that's like they're like 400 pounds and they're still in Costco eating the entire pizza by themselves. And you're like, come on, man. And so I just was like, what's wrong with humans? Why are they so weak? Why are they so incompetent? Why are they so, yeah, self-sabotaging? And the big frame that hit for me is what Gerzinger calls ecological rationality. If you're in a place where everybody lies and cheats and steals, the smartest thing to do in the Nash equilibrium is to defect also and not cooperate. And so when you meet somebody who's just like, whoa, he just stole my pen after meeting me for 5 minutes and left. Like, what the heck was that? It sounds just like bad, like they're a bad person. But actually, it's ecologically rational if you come from an environment where that type of scarcity is. And so the point here is, in the environments under which humans evolved, it was ecologically rational to be evolved to always orient towards the highest caloric density foods, whether it be fats or sugars, because it was so rare in the environment. So if there was fat in the form of bone marrow or a big animal, or there was sugar in the form of honey or a fruit, like you should be like all in and getting that. Like you should have no inhibitions because that is so rare. You just need all of your forces on the pedal, none on the brake. And that was smart. That was evolutionary matched. That was ecologically rational. There's nothing wrong with any of those inbuilt drives. The difficulty is we have the power of technology to completely change our environment, such that all of our natural instincts and drives and impulses are no longer rational in this new environment. They're mismatched to between our environment of evolution and our current environment. And now, you know, you want to like rush forward to that Krispy Kreme, and your body just says, has algorithms that say, get all that sugar. It's only your brain that has knowledge that says, wait, there's way too much sugar in this environment. I can't always be eating it. Stop, 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 stop. And that was like the key aha moment, which is like, let's stop blaming ourselves, saying like, oh, why am I always doom scrolling? Why am I opening so many new tabs? Why am I always addicted? Why is it first thing in the morning when I know I should be meditating, I'm scrolling through notifications like, oh, why me? What's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? The key insight of this evolutionary mismatch or ecological rationality frame is it's not your fault. You're running all these algorithms built for the savannah, built for a different era, that are now being commandeered by red bubbles, by notifications, by your phone. So instead of blaming ourselves, instead of saying like, get better, you know, you stupid fuck, get some willpower, you know, you lazy fuck, you know, grow the fuck up. All of that's true. We shouldn't take a victim mindset. We should be responsible. We should put our big boy pants on and grow up. But having said that, there's no reason for us to fight all of the programs and algorithms in us that actually were built in a very intelligent way. And so that was the big thing that hit me. So our relationship to technology is really about our relationship to the way we've evolved and our relationship to the way the environment is kind of taking advantage of it, this technological environment.
So can you tell us some ways in which we had that evolutionary mismatch between our devices and, you know, like what we ought to be doing, but what we end up doing?
Sure. Yeah. And what's cool about this principle is it goes across the entire stack, from the light, from the software, to the actual like physical reality of the device. So I'll just give a couple examples at each layer. So one thing is our hands are meant to be like carrying stones or spears or things like that. They're curled. That's like, think of like a DSLR grip that actually matches. Think of your devices. They're made thin. So your hands do this. That is not what a hand is meant to be doing. If it's meant to be doing
Can you bring it more towards the center so we can see it? Yeah, there you go.
You can't do this for long periods of time because your hand was not evolved to do that, which is why our hands hurt. We get carpal tunnel and all these things. It's because we're doing something it was not meant to do. Our body is so adaptive, you can force it to do it. but it will keep accumulating externality until it shows up as injury, right?
Hmm.
And so literally, at a basic level, we have chosen thinness, so it fits in your backpack or it looks great on an ad, at the cost of actually how human hands work and how they grip stuff and what muscles are strong and which muscles are weak and how you hold it. We can hold a thing for a long period of time if you hold it like this, if you hold it like holding a baseball or, you know, carrying a spear. That's not how you hold our computers. That's mismatched.
Mm-hmm.
Being stuck indoors all the time is another example of mismatch. Like, our biology heavily depends on being able to entrain onto a stable signal, which is the sun and its varying spectrum every day, outside of a solar eclipse or, you know, a big volcano going off, the sun is going to come. And so our biology, whatever drift it has internally in its different clocks, it always comes back to some sort of equilibrium with the entraining to the sun. Oh, okay, it's 1 p.m. Oh, okay, it's 8 a.m. Okay, growth hormone goes now. Insulin goes this. And when you're stuck inside, you're losing so much of that information and signal. And so your body is confused when the mismatch is even further worsened when our computer screens let off unbalanced blue light. Blue light in nature means 1 p.m. That's when the sun has the highest percentage of blue light. Sunrise, sunset, there's almost barely any blue light. And so if you're using a computer at 8 p.m., there's an evolutionary mismatch because your body's like, I guess it's 1 p.m. Let's do this to insulin. Let's do this to our pancreas. Let's do this. And then it's all confusing because you have other hints that, hey, I'm tired. My adenosine is here. My cortisol is there. Like, what's going on? And so essentially, you're just creating chaos in the body. And once again, it's just a mismatch. Your body is like, if I see blue, I will do this. That is a stable signal. And it's mismatched to the reality of we can artificially create blue now, and we do with our computer screens. And so that's one of the main insights behind daylight, is to solve this kind of blue light evolutionary mismatch and call it a lack of natural full spectrum sunlight, also entrainment or circadian rhythms. One other example is the red dots that you always see in your phone for notifications. The reason they choose red is it is our evolutionarily kind of directed response for danger or orienting or salience or, hey, it's a berry. And so that's why stop signs are red. This is just like something that we're like, whoa. And so you're taking something that's meant to look, go, whoa, and you're using it chronically every day, hundreds of times, to notice that your like aunt posted on Facebook, like, what the heck? Like, this is me for a water buffalo charging at us or a lion opening its mouth, and you're using it for Aunt Velma. Like, that, and so that's that sympathetic, that a constriction, that tension, that slight arousal that we go into when there is a red, there is an orienting, is basically being commandeered. So the, call it tech companies who make money on you spending your time, can further increase their next quarter's earnings to their shareholders. It's just like we shouldn't, we're basically abusing the color red to take advantage of an orienting response humans have that is very logical in a natural environment and is totally being taken advantage of. And we could go down a list of a lot more.
Well, I think your point about the blue light, even like when you have like a natural campfire or something like that, there's very little blue light in that. And, you know, it's much more towards like a warmer spectrum of light. And that's, you know, even in the evenings, like that's what you were used to. And like blue light is just so highly unusual to get into your eyes or something. But another one that that I think I've started to think about more recently since I've gotten your device is just having a lot of light. A lot of direct light that you are letting into your eyes. And I honestly wonder if a significant part of like people's eye problems, right? Like whether, you know, you need glasses or whatever, is due to the fact that your eyes are kind of getting irradiated. Almost all light that you saw in like a primitive environment is indirect. I mean, with the exception of maybe like a campfire or something like that. It was almost always like a reflection off of something. Like nobody stared at the sun. Maybe you'd look at the moon, but that's also reflected light. So it's very it makes me hesitant about like all of these devices, which are shining basically like this radiation, right? Like this, it's light and going straight into your eyes. And I'm like, maybe there's something to that. I don't know if there's any literature that you can quote or any thoughts on that, but that seems to be something significant as well.
No, that's huge. I would say that's one of the biggest examples of evolutionary mismatch, which is our ocular system, both at the cognitive level, our occipital lobe, down to the actual muscular level, involving the muscles, changing the focus of your eyes, things like that. They're all built for looking at physical reality outdoors, with reflected light, with bounced light. You know, the grass doesn't produce its own light, it's bouncing the sun. Like to your point, outside of fires, stars, fireflies, and glare off of water or snow, all light almost naturally was reflected. And you didn't necessarily stare into a campfire, 10 hours a day, especially didn't have blue light. So to your point, our ocular system, our saccades, everything is built for reflected light. And so, if you look in the natural hunter-gatherer world, like no one has sunglasses except for like Eskimos who, because the glare off of snow can be so high, they have these like snow glasses type things where they have tiny little slits and they cover the rest. It's like fascinating that they actually naturally evolved that. And outside of that, like basically no culture has sunglasses. Some variations of hats and this and that, to my knowledge. And so, yeah, the fact that our devices are emitting light, it's like, staring into a flashlight versus reflecting or bouncing light, which is what we are adapted and evolved for, that probably explains a tremendous amount of the migraines, the headaches, the eye strain, the dry eyes, and so on we face.
Or even like bad eyes, period.
What is it, the rate of glasses, of the rate of myopia in China? Went from 15% to like 85% or 90 in one generation.
And oh, wow.
The main suspect is they switched from learning characters, the Chinese characters on paper to computer screens.
I remember like the, vacuum tube TVs. I suspect that those were even worse because they emitted so much light and I don't know, I suspect like it was stronger and probably worse for you. LEDs at least maybe they're not quite as bad. I'm not really even sure how to quantify that really, but that's my suspicion is that maybe that was part of the eyes getting worse.
A key point of development in LEDs in terms of human factors ergonomics is they're collimated, i.e. they like are flashlights. But most natural light is diffuse. It bounces, disperses this way. So a lot of people are working on different things to make LEDs actually also disperse light, including ourselves.
Okay, so that was the first frame. It was evolutionarily, we're mismatched to the current environment. And what was the second one that you said?
Let's see if I remember. Can I try the third one? Because I remember the third one.
All right, let's go. Let's start with the third one. Maybe the second will come back. Yeah.
Yeah. So I call that fundamental attribution error or environmental design as the implication from it. So fundamental attribution error is, to me, one of the most profound discoveries in psychology that actually replicates, which is basically we over attribute to the person what is actually determined by the environment. I.e., hey, Joe's an asshole. We attribute it to Joe, but quite often it's like Joe is really scared. He's not going to submit his proposal in time to his boss, and therefore is short-tempered with everybody. I.e., we like to say Jimmy's a good guy, Anjin's a bad guy. This da 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 da. But actually, most of our behavior can be determined or explained or nudged by the environment more than our intrinsicness. So the famous example of this, and the point I'm trying to make is we keep talking about ourselves when really the environment both matter, but the environment can really matter more than we suspect. And that the famous example is they invited these good Samaritans to Yale to give a talk. And, you know, these are these priests who are known as the Samaritans, and they're famous for being very gregarious and giving and in service. And so they tell them that their talk starts at 4:30 or something like that, and to please show up at this auditorium. And then they purposefully send them to the wrong auditorium. They're all there at like 4:10 or 4:15, and they say, "Oh my God, we're so sorry. It's actually the other auditorium on the other side of Yale." And, you know, it's about 15 minutes to get there, and then the thing starts at 4:30, so they had to leave immediately. Along the way, they planted all these people, like homeless people and things like that, to then ask for alms and to beg for, "Excuse me, would it be possible to get some food or some money or some regard?" And what they noticed is, some of the good Samaritans were told the right place to go to, and they leisurely ambled over. It didn't matter that it was good Samaritans. What mattered more was whether they were in a rush or not. And the good Samaritans that were in a rush to try to get to the other side, basically like 90% of them didn't give anything to the homeless people. And the ones that were leisurely walking, I think it was like 70% gave something. Don't quote me on any of these numbers. I think I forgot.
But that's the idea. That's the
basic idea. And so this guy named Lee Ross, the Stanford professor, has a book called "The Person in the Situation," which is just full of examples like this. Goes to basically show our environment matters way more than any of us think it does. And that is terrifying in some sense, because it means if the environment is not set up for your interest, you can be deeply manipulated. But it's also super empowering, because it means our growth isn't fully linked to willpower, i.e. doing it inside. And you can actually design your environment in better and better, more intentional ways. And you can just kind of be yourself, and you'll be a higher version of yourself. And that's why things like Bitcoin and so on are fascinating, because you're changing the external environment to allow humans to show up in a different, potentially much better way. And so the point here was, I was on a plane. I had a Tolstoy book that I was trying to read for a long time. It wasn't because I'm pretentious. It was because someone told me he's the best psychologist of our time. So read Tolstoy if you really want to understand human nature. And I've been trying to read it for 6 months, and it's intimidating. It's Tolstoy. I feel like a douche. But I was in a plane, and it was a really cheap flight, so they didn't even have, like, you know, the screens. And I got bored of picking my nose after a while. I picked out the book. There was nothing to do. There was one of those old planes that didn't have Wi-Fi. And I just was so bored, I started to read it. And before you know it, I read like 60 pages and read a significant portion of the book. I think it was The Death of Ivan Illich. And I was just like, holy shit, I'm the same person. I have the same willpower. I have the same stories of like a lack of self-worth. I have the same feelings that, oh man, I'm just like not good enough. But here I am doing something that I'd intended to do for 6 months, and I did it basically effortlessly, and it was pleasurable, and it was fun, and I liked it. What changed? I didn't change. I didn't pull on my big boy pants any higher. The only thing changed was the environment. The airplane was an environment that set me up such that the path of least resistance was in line with my highest intention. I.e., it's not necessarily that Anjan needs to significantly change, even though, you know, I've done a lot of work with this. It's you can also set up the environment to create a certain version of yourself. And that was a breakthrough. It's when we are creating technologies, truly we're changing the external and internal environments. And if we could do it intentionally, such that it's in line with our highest intentions, with a lot less effort, with a lot less willpower, with a lot more consistency, you could get the intended behaviors and capacities you wanted. And that's what, like, the frame of like what my relationship to technology is. Like, now instead of getting distracted and opening 500 tabs, I use a Chrome extension that will start secretly deleting tabs when I get more than 10.
That's funny.
And then my girlfriend will come back if I've ever deleted the Chrome extension and re-download it. So it's like, and like, I'm the same person, but now just I have a little bit more presence before I open a new tab, because I'm like, oh man, it's going to delete something. And so that's really the way I think about designing an operating system, designing the future of a phone, redesigning notifications, whatever it is let's not blame the person. Let's change the external environment, including the technology, so you can be the equivalent of so bored in a plane, you start reading.
So with regard to all of these distractions in the technology stack that we see, one of the more obvious things is that we're kind of constantly distracted, and they're like kind of like puppies or something that all need their attention. How does that manifest itself in us, and how does that change us, and how's that make us act in ways that maybe we don't want to act, that's not sort of like our best intent?
Yeah, there's whole books written about this, so yeah. we could talk about the whole concept of cognitive disinhibition, why everybody yells and is mean to each other on the internet. There's a nice theory that it's hate is a way of participating without being vulnerable, and actually that is an indication of how much we deeply want to care and love for each other. You know, we're all on the same team, the same species, but it's so vulnerable and so distant. So anyways, there's a lot to be said about the deep societal and philosophic implications of these digital defaults. So for example, there's a Telegram group I'm part of where once you send a message, it makes you wait 15 seconds before you can send the second message. And it's like the highest quality discourse of any like large WhatsApp group or so on I'm part of, just because of that one slight default change. And to me, that's like why there's like a key, big depth to your question of like, what are all the implications of these distractions or the way technology is? And I think implications are massive. I think it's not just about a little bit of lost time here. I don't think it's just a little bit of lost sleep here. I think we're talking the depths of agency and democracy and freedom. There's a book called Stand Out of Our Light by James Williams. I highly recommend. It's super small. And his main point is, we call it distraction. We almost do it a disservice because we make it sound like it's just a small little distracting thing, like a mosquito, you know, buzzing beside your ear. You're just trying to smack it away. He's like, what distraction is actually the sucking of your life force energy. If you think about why you poop and why you eat and so on, is so you have free time to actually pursue your highest goals, right? You maintain your body every day so you have free time to pursue your highest goals, whether that's in service as a mother or whether it's creating educational content or inventing new technologies or doing Broadway plays. And what is happening is at scale, we are being mined of that free time, of that agentic time, to basically feed unaccountable corporations whose business models have no alignment with actual like social benefit. And so when we're talking about in the morning, you wake up and the first thing that hits you is, this happened in Gaza, and Paris Hilton did this, and here are three things that, and you're missing three stories, and look to who looked at your profile. It's like before you have a chance to be like, wait, my life is fucked. Why am I voting for this guy again? Like, you're already fucking, you know, numbed over with stimulation. Like, you're literally stimmed to death. Like, Brave New World, if you've heard of that book, describes this so well, which is 1984. They use coercion and fear and force to keep you enslaved. In Brave New World, they use pleasure and indulgence and stimulation and distraction to keep you so blissed out or so overwhelmed or so stimmed out, you've lost your sense of agency. You don't even notice you're a slave. You don't even notice you're not free. And so I think it's literally the fact that all of us use, or most of us, our phone as our alarm. So every morning, we're woken up in stress because it's da-da-da-da-da-da-da, right? That's pretty crazy to think almost every human wakes up every morning in stress. And then immediately you're bombarded with the thoughts and needs and wants of all of these people who have no accountability for taking your time. Like, how the fuck are you supposed to live a free life if you can't even want what you want, if you don't even have time to ponder? There's a great book, I'm forgetting the author's name, where they said leisure is the source of culture. Culture is only created when there's leisure. And leisure is having spaces of nothingness. You know, it's having a cigar and sitting somewhere. It's in front of a fire. It's looking up at the stars. It's not watching Netflix. That is not leisure. That's consumption. Stuff is coming into you. There, his definition of leisure is creating a space of, it's like a pregnant pause. It's a space of openness, of receptivity. and then the whispers inside of you can come out, right? The parts that say, wait, why am I doing this job? Like, what's going on? You can't do that if leisure for you is constantly stuffing more stuff into your head. And so you could argue that the removal of the spaces in the morning, which are just to you, where you can notice and diagnose and metacognate about your life, which is the foundation of freedom and agency, is being stolen and scavenged from us. You want to talk about how they keep us all as fucking lemmings? Maybe we start there with stupid notifications in the morning where you don't even get time to yourself. This is never before possible. Even if you were a slave, you still got your morning. Now the emperor can control you unaccountably every morning of your rest of your life. Oh, there's no rebellion. Oh, no one's complaining. Yeah, because the opium of the masses is notifications, right? The opium of the masses is red bubbles. The opium of the masses is hijacking your brainstem. And so this is what kind of galvanized my action is, oh, wow, this is not just about distraction. This is truly about agency, truly about freedom, truly about sovereignty, truly about being not a slave.
Yeah, I think it's Augustine that said man has as many masters as vices, something like that. And in a sense, all of these distractions are really vices. They're things that we're kind of addicted to, and sort of do. The more available they are, the harder it is to resist, right? Like if you're on a diet and you have like a plate of cookies like at your kitchen table that you pass by 30 times a day, it's going to be much harder to keep your diet than if it's away. And that's, I think, the concept that you're talking about is, you know, designing your environment in a way to for success instead of failure. And I think what you're saying is the digital environment that we're in is more or less designed to make us fail at whatever we're trying to do. And, you know, we rationalize it by saying, I need to, you know, get back to these people whenever and make sure that I'm on top of things and whatnot. And, you know, I mean, some of that's true, certainly. But for the most part, it enslaves us and our time and really our lives, because the you know, willpower that you would put towards something that's actually meaningful and useful and value providing end up going towards the things that are completely not that are essentially giving another click to some large tech company.
And here's what, like, the analogy that made it really land for my sister was, do you know when you're at a party and you're like done talking with somebody, but you can tell that they're like hungry and they just like don't let you go and they just keep talking and talking and your feet are pointed this way, your body language there, but they're, and you're like, okay. And they just keep talking. Doesn't it feel terrible? Like they're just stealing your life force energy from you. They're just stealing from you. It's like the worst feeling. That's what's happening, dude. That's what all these tech companies are doing when they're getting us all doom scrolling and distracted and addicted. It's that guy at their party who's just hungry. He's just using you so he doesn't feel lonely. He's taking from you. And look how sensitive we are in a party for someone to take 2 or 3 minutes of our time that way. And imagine that we're pissing away like an hour or 2 hours a day. Something like the average 14-year-old is spending like 4 hours on YouTube or on social media. I don't even know. I'm like, wait, school ends at 3 p.m. How do you even have time to do that? And so, yeah, we are well attuned in real life to not have people steal our time who don't have our best interests in mind. It's just the digital goes past all of our evolved mechanisms, right? And we blame ourselves. I wasted an hour. It must be my fault.
Yeah, it's all like sort of highly addictive sugar or something like that. Yeah. And we're like, okay, well, I guess it's fine now because everyone else does it. But that's, it's not a way to live. And I suspect it's even changed in maybe even like the last 20 years how addicted people are to these things and would rather do that. One of the things that I, you know, now that I have your device, one of the things that I've discovered again on my laptop is the off button. You know, it's like, you know what? I should really just turn this off because I'm so much more cognizant of how much of my time goes into stuff that doesn't matter or like that's and I thought I've cut a lot of that stuff out. I have a family and stuff, so I'm used to like eliminating excess, but man, there's a lot of fat there. It's kind of like cutting out sugar. It's like you end up losing 20 pounds on it. I thought I was already in shape and skinny. Where did those 20 pounds come from? Well, it's in stuff like this where, you know, there's 10 minutes here, there's 30 minutes here, and you know, going through Twitter and searching stuff that you don't need to search, and it's all there to sort of like draw your life out, and like it's a succubus, right? Like it's taking some of your life away in exchange for really not even that satisfactory pleasure.
That's the worst part about it, is you don't necessarily feel good afterwards. Like it's not even like, I don't know, if you sneak out of school to go to a concert, like you feel pretty good afterwards, even if there are consequences. This, you just feel shitty. I guess it must be like what it's like being addicted to a substance of sorts. And yeah,
or you know, like people that are addicted to porn, right? Like right afterwards they just feel terrible. Or if you're eating donuts, it's like, oh, did I just eat like 20 of those, you know? Or almost anything, really.
Right, like smoking. You don't necessarily start feeling good. You just don't feel bad. And somebody had a great line. Yeah. They said, like, we're going to look back at this kind of, like, unaccountable technology use and blue light and kind of full-on addiction and see it as the smoking of, like, of our generation. You know, everybody thought it was fine back then. You can do it in front of your kids. You do it all the time. Right? And it was only after a long period of time we're like, holy shit. I think it'll be, like, the same thing. Because does Tolstoy write Tolstoy? If he's trying to do it on a computer with Facebook and ESPN and YouTube two tabs away, like, would he be unable to do it? Like, I think that's such an interesting question. Like, you take all these incredible thinkers in time, you take Hayek, you take Basquiat, whatever it may be, put them on our technological landscape, and it's like, are they going to be able to do it? Are they going to be able to focus? Like, are they going to actually finish that work? Like, is Van Gogh just going to be on Pornhub all day instead of, like, you know?
Probably. Like that's the crazy thing is, like, if you study the lives of a lot of geniuses, what you find is that early on, they were tremendously bored, right? Like, they just had hours and hours where they didn't have anything to do. And they ended up kind of like your example of reading your Tolstoy book. They ended up going and, oh, you know what? I find this math interesting. And they started really getting into it because that was what they had to do. They didn't have anything else. Whereas we have so many options now of, I don't know, like I read an article a long time ago that said like quality time sinks or something like that. Mm. It's like, and for a company, I suppose that's how they would view it. But really, they're stealing our time, and it's like a debasement of our life in so many ways.
Yeah, I mean, it's the only thing you can't create more of. You can't print more time, so they're just trying to take as much of it as they can. If they could print more time, they would. I mean, they do. They create bots, right? I mean, bots are trying to fake, you know, trying to print time to get more money from folks.
Yeah. Oh man.
By the way, and a lot of Facebook's money is small businesses putting up ads, and the small business makes $3 on the trinket, and Facebook made $2.75 on the trinket. It's just like Mark Zuckerberg turning everybody into their fiefdom. Like, he makes as much money as almost every small business going through it, right? So people don't realize that.
Yeah.
A lot of small businesses rely on Instagram and Facebook ads, and he's just taking most of their margin.
He's a rent seeker, basically. And he's monetizing your attention. So what was that second point? Do you remember yet?
Yeah, it's a homogenization of the people building it and the homogenization of their assumptions about the people who use it and the homogenization, therefore, of the technology. So I'll speak a bit imprecisely, so don't I might be a little crass. But basically, like, you look at Facebook, it's Zuck and it's Moskovitz and it's Andrew Bosworth and it's all these Harvard people. Or it's Chris Cox and so on, and it's Stanford people. You look at Google, it's Larry Page and Sergey Brin and Scott Hassan, and, you know, they're all Stanford people. Microsoft, Steve Ballmer, Harvard, Bill Gates, Harvard, you know, Bezos, Princeton, not as much social. You look at the folks who built these things and you look at who their early networks of folks they recruited, it was Harvard and Stanford and Ivy Leagues and so on. And if you think at least more and more in the modern world, so take a Google or a Facebook, the people who get into the Stanfords and Harvards in this day and age are the people who contort themselves to the system. Mm-hmm. They go to Kenya and volunteer. They do the SAT boot camps. They work with the. It's all about how well can you contort yourself into this. You don't live your life. You're not like a flower blossoming in whatever way feels most natural to you. It's like, how do I get onto 30 under 30, right? It's this algorithmic working backwards. And so there's a total homogenization of the types of folks who get into these schools, even if on paper they look different, you know. I'm a bit of a hypocrite here, or maybe you can trust me as a sleeper cell. I went to Stanford, so I got to see this firsthand. And what it means is the people in these companies, they are there because they're high conscientiousness, high systematicity, high conformity, high obedience, not only the founders, but all these early employees. So when they're designing their thing and showing it to their friends and showing it to their family, it's the same homogenous group of folks who are basically kind of normies. Right? They just sit down, get their job done, do really well on their math tests, like listen to their teachers, get 10 out of 10 in participation marks, and then, you know, get into Harvard. And that's the people who are designing the software. And so there's a total, in my opinion, homogeneity of the psychological assumptions and feedback loops that inform the software interfaces that we get. And so for them, they honestly believe that this is good and useful and great and not problematic. And those of us who are a little bit more neurodivergent, a little bit more on the frontiers, a little bit more ADHD or autistic or dyslexic or, you know, creative or right-brained or whatever you want to say, we don't even realize how different the people who are sitting in the chairs in Cupertino or in Menlo Park or in Mountain View in the Bay Area doing this are to us. Because a lot of folks who are more right-brained or neurodivergent aren't the most conscientious, aren't sitting there getting 2350 on their SAT, aren't a project manager on the Facebook feed at this particular thing. Right? But we're the ones who are pioneering new monetary systems and figuring out new ways of education and finding new ways of reinventing computers, right? We're the weirdos, the misfits, the mischievous ones. And the people making computers, because of the nature of the system, because of what it takes to get into a Stanford, Harvard, what it takes to then get into a Facebook or a Google, is they're very different than potentially the people like us. And so what that means is there isn't a representation of different neurotypes, of different psychological assumptions, of different psychological feedback loops in their creation. And I mean it in the most simple sense. Like if I make something and I show it to you, because you're, you know, somebody I know, your brain type is going to have influence on the way I built it. But if everybody I show it to is a 2300 SAT whose sphincter is a little bit too tight and they're behind, you know, like you're going to get a certain type of feedback and you're going to be convinced, hey, I listen to people. I talk to people. You know, don't tell me that I didn't talk to people. And so that's why I feel like a lot of us just feel like computers aren't built for us and there isn't necessarily a feedback loop around it. It's because of this homogenization that I think comes back to the homogenization at the schooling and college admissions level. And so
I would say that
people, and I think this is a big way AI helps. It helps, you know, the Thomas Edison innovation is 99% perspiration, 1% inspiration. I think a lot of that 99% could be done by AI. So that 1% inspiration ends up being 50 or 99% of what matters. So one of my theories is, neurodivergent people start to take over the world when AI helps them with the conscientious side of them.
Interesting. Well, so it's interesting that you see it as sort of like this homogenizing force. For me, what I've observed about the education system is that it essentially selects for compliance, right? Like people that are very good at complying in sometimes creative ways, to be honest, right? Like, so they're very creative in their compliance. But still, like, the number one thing that school teaches you is how to basically do what the teachers told you to do. And the people that are almost always the most successful are the people that are the most compliant. There's a study I read a while back about, like, the, you know, a lot of people have heard of the marshmallow test, right? Like the kid that can wait for the second marshmallow. Yeah, you know, they track them through life and so on. And I read this other sort of like take on the marshmallow test, which I hadn't heard before, because it was always sort of seen as, okay, which kids are willing to wait, right? It's sort of like a low time preference test. And they were saying that that's not what that test was testing. What that test was testing was the kid's ability to comply. Mm. Because despite the fact that, you know, the adult says, you know, you can have one now or you can have two in 5 minutes, the kids are smart enough to understand, okay, what the adult wants me to do is to wait 5 minutes. Mm. And the kids that did the best on those are the ones that complied the most. Oh, wow. And it's like, and that actually determines success. Wow. In a lot of like fiat economies. Wow. Which is essentially what you have. So in that sense, what I think is happening with like a lot of these tech companies is that they end up complying to whatever their boss wants. And ultimately, the boss in all of these companies ends up being the public market, the people that want profit. And it's not necessarily like long-term profit. It's almost always like short-term profit. And what's going to get you short-term profit? Well, it's ads. It's stealing your time. It's getting your attention. It's getting you to FOMO into the latest iPhone, despite the fact that you can't afford it. And it's doing those things. Mm. And in a sense, you've put the sociopaths in charge, and taken out a lot of the humanity that people would normally have. But it's been sort of like beat out of them through this compliance test of 16 or 17 years or however long you're in school. So that seems to me like a big part of why these things are designed that.
If you don't mind me also sharing a reflection, like a personal reflection that comes up from that. I wonder if the reason I'm able to do this is because my mom was such a tiger mom, so pushing down on me. I went the opposite. I'm like, I will never comply. I will always push back. I will always fight back. And it's almost like if I could handle her, then the rest of the world's a piece of cake, you know, and it's like pushing me down and make me comply. And I wonder if that's actually, in many ways, my greatest weakness and the strength that has kept this company alive and going is not willing to comply.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly sort of like the sense I get in... Let's talk about the device now, right? Like, because I have it here, and it's a wonderful device. It's not on right now, but it's like a reflective screen for the most part. But there were a lot of things that actually surprised me about the device. It's a flavor of Android, but it's not Android per Google, right? There's no Google Play Store in there. There's a different app store where you don't even have to log in. There's a lot of privacy features built in. You know, there are certain Google services that are on most Android phones and Android tablets that are not on this thing, which makes it like a lot more self-sovereign. So tell me about your vision for this device, because you are trying to correct a lot of these, I guess, flaws with the devices that we already have and the sort of technology sort of that's there to suck the life out of you. You know, it's a technical succubus, I guess. And instead, it's more something that's sort of helping you do what you want. So tell me more about like your built philosophy and what you're hoping people will get out of it.
Right. I'm gonna play with a way of describing it that feels dumb, but it's as if Costco and Apple had a baby and it was decentralized. That's what we're doing. I think there's a joke that Costco is the most effective, sustainable charity in America. And if you know anything about their business model, it actually, the amount of money they save people is incredible. Mm. Regardless of how well they negotiate something in the world, they go find some olive oil somewhere that's $100, they negotiate down to 20. They could charge 40 and everybody would love it. They only just charge a 15% markup. So everything else goes to consumer surplus. That's all money back in the pocket of the customer. And they just make money on the membership fee. That's how they keep themselves alive. So Costco's basic business model is keep the company alive by paying our membership fee, and in return, we will then try to just get you amazing quality goods and amazing deals on all of them, because we're not dependent on the sales of those goods to keep the company alive. And to me, that as a business model innovation is going to be crucial to actually pulling off decentralized Apple. Imagine Apple was founded today. You know, and what it means to be Apple is you can do everything in a computer. You can do the software, you can do the hardware, you can do the supply chain, you can do the LEDs to make sure they don't have blue light. You can do the integrations into Nostr or Bitcoin or whatever it may be. At every layer of the stack, you can control the experience, whether it's hardware, whether it's software, whether it's design, whether it's community. And you're not going to be able to do that. And just because your good intentions, hope you don't rent seek. It's going to be because of the way you finance the business, because of your business model that allows you to be different. And like, my feeling is a Costco-esque business model where on the computers is not necessarily how you the company stays alive. You know, you'll make some margin on it, 15, 25, whatever percent, but it's some sort of membership fee. And the social contract that you can't prove, but you're hoping people will trust you over time is, hey, as long as you pay the membership fee, we will try to be absolutely pro-social about our products that we sell. It'll always be in the best interest of the customer, because we don't need to lock you in to our photo service. We don't need to lock you in to our storage service. We don't need that rent seeking. And we're not trying to become a public company. We're not trying to become a $3 trillion company. You know, we could still be pretty big, but there's no need for that level of accumulation. And so that's the kind of vision here, is if Apple was started and it was pro-social and it understood the need to pick technological primitives in the networking stack, in the protocols, in the operating system that are in the best interest of society. And it made its choices based on what I would call the values that I most align with, which is physical sovereignty or integrity, which we call health, you know, mental sovereignty or integrity, you know, which we call peace of mind or being not distracted. Then the rest of the stack can kind of be built around that. And so that's what we're trying to do. You can say decentralized Apple with a Costco business model.
Well, I like your subscription idea, and I'll tell you why.
Because, and it's a membership. Sounds like it's a subscription, but slight difference in what actually.
Yeah. I'll tell you why I like it. The reason is because I think what fiat money has done is it lets you sort of like it makes it more profitable to get like sort of lifetime value out of the customer instead of having the customer pay things up front. In almost every other era, you just paid for something and that was it. Instead, you have like all these SaaS models and things like that, where you're trying to like sort of like shear the sheep forever, right? Like your customers are like your property or something, and they try to keep getting things from you, and usually they do that by getting you in the door for free, right? And that's the freemium model is like the major software model. You know, the free Google search and free Facebook account and free whatever, these are all pretty problematic, because then you become the product. Whereas if you're paying for something, there's something sacred about the transaction itself, where you're not serving me ads and things like that. You're not monetizing me because I'm paying you. And that means that you have some obligation to me instead of the other way around. I recently, for example, started using Kagi. A search engine that's different than Google. Yeah. It promises me that they're not going to keep track of anything. And, you know, it has like rudimentary AI features and things like that. It's just sort of trying to make my life better. And I'm willing to pay for it so that I don't get tracked, that Google doesn't know all this stuff about me. And I think we at some point we have to be willing to pay for the stuff that's actually valuable, because if companies are giving you valuable stuff for free, well, they're going to sell you out to go and make that up. And I'd rather just pay up front than say, here's the money. You have like sort of like a contract with me. You're obligated to me because I'm paying you. That's a much healthier relationship than me being a sheep in your sheepfold that gets sheared every 6 months through ads or something like that. So I really want more of those models. I understand that a lot of people are more resistant to those because they'd rather get something for free and sort of feel like they're getting a bargain. But I promise you that, you know, like a lot of what we experience with our devices, like, you know, the blue light and the tabs and the doom scrolling, you know, that's just like an alternative way in which you're paying for all of it.
Beautiful. Wow.
Yeah. I can't hear you. Did you?
I'm speechless. So no.
Very nice. Yeah. So it's one of those things that I really hope that that takes off. Can you tell us a little bit more about, like, you know, when the device is going on sale? Sure. And where people can buy it? Because honestly, every single person that I've showed it to wants one. It's kind of rare that you get that. I think people are very aware of this problem, even if they can't put words to their, I don't know, I guess, dread about, like, technology and, like, knowing sort of where it's taking them. Like, where can people get it and stuff like that? When can they buy it and so on?
First, thank you. That's incredibly validating. It's been 6 years working in the shadows, most of it bootstrapped. I have no idea if anybody else outside myself would like this. So it means a lot to hear your reflection in the way people are doing it. Once again, what the product is essentially, if a Kindle and an iPad had a baby, we basically made a healthy iPad. Imagine an iPad that you take a samurai sword to, and you got rid of notifications, you got rid of distractions, you got rid of blue light, you got rid of flicker, you got rid of eye strain, and you can use it outside in the sun. And the battery life lasts a long period of time, and it kind of feels like paper to write on it. It's kind of a minimalist, reduced version of an iPad that cares about your health, that cares about your attention, and cares about your privacy and security and sovereignty. So for most people, it should hopefully be a drop-in replacement for an iPad or an upgrade over their Kindle or Remarkable tablet. It's launching on May 23rd. It's been 6 years to make this. We invented the technology, invented a new display technology. And you can go to daylightcomputer.com to put a pre-order deposit down. And if you're a friend of Jimmy's, we'll give you the secret link, which is health.daylightcomputer.com. And the password is daylight, all caps. And you can actually buy the full unit from that. Please don't share that too widely. Yeah, we're excited. We're starting with a tablet. It's useful for kids. It's useful for grandparents. It's useful for Sudoku puzzles. It's useful reading the Bitcoin white paper. It's in many ways a replacement for, you know, a printout, a piece of paper, a legal pad, Moleskine. But what comes next, if we're successful with the tablet, is we'll take that cash flow and put it towards building a phone, and then a laptop, a monitor. And a big part of what we want to do is make sure that the primitives the operating system is built with are pro-social. And so we're very fascinated with the idea of, you know, your daylight ID, even if it just looks like a daylight ID, you know, like your Apple ID, but actually underneath is a distributed identity. It's Noster or something like that. You know, if you're reading articles on this thing, your Apple Pay, your Daylight Pay on the surface looks like Daylight Pay, but underneath it's Lightning or eCash or something like that. Mm-hmm. To the user, it's all the same. And so we're fascinated by the prospect of integrating deeply with kind of peer-to-peer, you know, kind of orange-pilled communities and finding developers who can build on our thing, people who want to join the team to help us do that and buy the product, because if we don't sell enough units, the manufacturer cuts us off. We kind of found a glitch in the matrix. We're doing a new display, and our minimum order quantity, i.e. the minimum units you need to do, is 15 to 20,000, call it 20. Hmm. Usually that's 500,000. So the hope is within the first year we can sell 20,000 of these, and the hope is we have created a pretty reasonable product. It's got flaws. It's early. Don't expect it to be Apple standards across the board, but I guess Jimmy can share how it is. But.
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you right now that it's become like my primary driver. I find myself using my computer less, my phone less. I'm doing a lot more reading of books because it's there. And, you know, if I need to, I can check my email. I can watch a YouTube video. It's in black and white, but I can still watch it. It's great for, like, PDFs and stuff like that because it's so responsive, and I can zoom in, write notes on it. There's a stylus that comes with it. I don't know if you mentioned that, but you can write things on it. I find myself doing things that I'm more in control, and it's more a help to me and my goals. So, for example, I'm learning Latin and Greek, mm-hmm. right? Like, and I have different texts that I'm going through and things like that. I have like Anki flashcards yeah. for stuff, and so I do those rather than doom scroll Twitter or watch like YouTube videos and stuff, because it's not as engaging. The bright lights aren't there. It's not all in color. It's almost like I've fenced my technology so that it works for mm-hmm. me, instead of sort of taking whatever the big tech companies give me and using it the way they want mm-hmm. me to, because they, I promise you, they don't have my best interests in mind. And I think we've made that case throughout this podcast. But that for me has been tremendous in sort of like progressing some of the stuff, because I have like a Fit Notes app on there, right? And that's like a workout app where you just log like stuff that you're doing. I take this device with me to my garage gym, and in between sets, I'll be reading something or studying Latin or whatever. And it feels like it's enhancing my life rather than my phone, which oftentimes is just sort of a distraction to my life. And I like that, right? Like, I think that's what technology should be. It should be something that helps me be more productive in the things that I want to do, rather than sort of end up doing the things that Google, Apple, or Facebook, or whatever want me to do. Wow. And that for me is a major benefit. And I don't think any other tech company is even thinking along those lines. They are not interested in your health. They just want to give you, sell you more crack, basically. And not, hey, maybe you should, exercise and do other stuff. It's this sort of like digital, it's been like 30 years of the internet, right? And it's funny that we haven't really talked about like how detrimental it can be. And we've instead like not even thought about these things. And I'm for that reason, I'm grateful that you've like brought it to mine and my audience's attention, because I think, if you think about it, significant amount of our time goes into doing things that other people want us to do rather than wow. what we yeah. want to do. And I think this is a big part of self-sovereignty, is getting rid of your vices. Mm. You have as many masters as vices, and these are vices, right? Like you're addicted to a lot of stuff. So, I can't recommend this thing enough. And Anja's not paying me. I don't have any financial interest in his company. I did buy this thing from him. He didn't give it to me for free. It's a device that I've wanted for a very long time. I really hope you consider buying a device, even if it's just to support, the goals that he has. But I promise you, like, once you get this and set it up the way, that aligns with whatever goals you have, that it will enhance your life, and that you'll learn the off button on both your phone and your computer and use this thing instead.
Wow. That's beyond our wildest dreams, Jimmy. You make something, you hope it's slightly useful for somebody, but just to hear the way you describe it, like with the Latin or for exercises or Anki or so on, that's the biggest hope we could have, is these are tools of nurturing to get to your highest self versus tools of degradation that take you down to your lowest self. And what a beautiful example you're sharing in your own life.
Yeah, it's so strange, but like I think for most people, computers are like a debasement of their life rather than an enhancement of their productivity. And I think what you're trying to do is make it more the latter. And by the way, how much is the device? I'm sure people are going to ask about that.
$799.
So. Okay, yeah, guys, it's a computer replacement. It's worthwhile, and you should definitely think about it. It's way better than any of these e-reading devices because it's way more responsive. Totally worth it, at least in my opinion.
It's a first gen. It's kind of like a Tesla Roadster. You got to start here when you write the cost curve down. So we make very little money at $799, if any.
All right. Well, thanks so much. Where can people find you? Where can people contact you?
On Twitter, Noster, Instagram at Daylight Co. And then you can go to our website, daylightcomputer.com. You can email hello@daylightcomputer.com if you have any questions. And the secret link, if you want to buy the full unit instead of just a deposit, is health.daylightcomputer.com. And the password is all caps daylight. And you'll be one of the first people to do it. We're doing things in 1,000 batches, and you guys will be one of the first if you're part of that.
All right. You heard it here. All right. Thanks, Anja.
Thanks, Jimmy. Incredible.
Unchained Capital is a sponsor of this podcast. I'm an advisor to the company. I know the team well, and I'm excited for what they are building. If you need multi-sig, collaborative custody, or a Bitcoin-native financial services partner, learn more at unchained.com.